Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Dr. Jeremy Barmé makes a welcome return, a welcome but belated return to the Sydney Institute, but we've followed his work over the years, and an international China scholar. But I'll introduce him briefly. He's currently director of the Australian Centre on China in the World in Canberra. He's also professor of Chinese history at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's a filmmaker, he's an author, he's a translator. But he's here on this occasion due to the recent launch of the China Story Yearbook 2012, Red Rising, Red Eclipse, which he has edited. Now, there will be some hard copies which can be printed on demand later. Currently, the work is a Kindle and a PDF. It can be printed on demand later, as I said. But essentially, it's an online book. And so tonight, Dr. Barmé is going to talk to us on China, a matter of facts. Jeremy Barmé, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jared, thank you so much for your kind invitation, and thank you as well. I'd like to address some of the things that have gone in, the thinking that's gone into this project to do with what we call the China story. It's a story we're all obsessed with in Australia for very good reason. And I'd like to say a few words about how we at the Australian Centre on China and the World try to think about it. And then I'll tell you about the website project we've created and the book that we've just produced and the ongoing plans we have as a way of helping inform the public, providing academic insight, and I believe there is such a thing, and information to a broader public free of charge, which I think, being a public institution, publicly funded, we believe that's very important. A famous line, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. This is the famous opening of Joan Didion's 1979 The White Album, a series of autobiographical essays about the 1960s. Now, we all know that individuals create narratives related to their own lives, as do groups, societies, political parties, and nations. From the dying days of the Chinese Qing Dynasty in the late 19th century, the thinker and reformist Liang Qichao wrote about the pressing need that China had to have a new history, to write a history for itself, one that would both reflect its changed realities, the end of dynastic rule, and help to make it a modern, progressive, powerful, and wealthy nation. Now, history and national narratives express aspirations as well as a range of political agendas. Now, as we know, Australia too is a country that tells itself stories, some of which are very much in conflict. At around the time that the Chinese Communist Party's General Secretary, the President of China, Hu Jintao, announced a new campaign to outline the eight glories and the eight shames of Chinese culture, Barong Bachi, as they're called, in 2006, you may recall that our then Prime Minister, Liberal Coalition leader John Howard, and his Education Minister, Brendan Nelson, were championing a list of more than the Chinese, nine values for Australian schooling. They were part of a response to our local history wars. Now, in China, history wars have been happening for over a century. Many of those who engage with the Chinese world today encounter the stories that are told about China. There is, of course, the narrative of the monolithic party state, the Dan War, that strange combination of party power and state policy. Stories of economic boom and government repression, accounts of the China model, and of the fragile one-party dictatorship. These are but a couple of the stories about China. Then there are the multiple tales of individuals and companies, of resilient entrepreneurism, of communities, as well as an array of other accounts that are told about that country. Some of these attempt to deepen an understanding of the Chinese world and the perspectives that Chinese citizens, thinkers, business people have on the rise of China and on the world at large. And then there are the accounts that evoke familiar stereotypes and make it harder rather than easier to appreciate the complex realities of contemporary China. For its part, since the Beijing Olympic year of 2008, the People's Republic of China has increasingly focused on what is called telling the China story. This is an expression that I take from the former Chinese ambassador to Australia, Fu Ying's remarks. She said China in 2008 and 9, she said, we have to get better at telling our story to the international community. Now, of course, understanding the official China story, as well as some crucial variations of it, telling Chinese stories, so to speak, is crucial to a broad-based engagement with the contemporary Chinese world, but it's not the only way we can engage. I think of there as being, in fact, regarding the China story in modern decades, four moments of, to use a computer, it's a fashionable computer term, four disconnects, four moments in which there's been a rupture in understanding, for good reason. Since the Cultural Revolution, there have been these four, which ended in 1976 or 78, depending on how you want to calibrate things. The initial disconnect came in late 1978. Around that time, there was a plenary session of the Chinese Communist Party that launched China on its policies of economic reform and openness. At around the same time, public protest was overwhelming the streets of Beijing, in particular at one place at the Xidan intersection on Chang'an Avenue in the center of the city, where people of all backgrounds stuck up large wall posters in what became known as the Beijing Spring of late 1978, early 79. One of the most famous, or the most famous of all the posters, called for China's not only modernization as an agricultural, industrial, technological and military nation, but the modernization of Chinese politics, the creation of Chinese democracy. That poster was written by a famous man who went on to become a dissident, or named as known as a dissident, Wei Jingsheng. And his detention, arrest, and eventual jailing were part of the first disconnect between international perceptions of what would be and should be happening in China and what the Chinese authorities wanted us to think was the main flow of Chinese history. The year 1989 saw another bifurcation in the understanding of China and its trajectory since the inauguration of the Chinese economic reforms. For some, or many in fact, the events of June the 3rd and 4th, 1989, represent a split in perception as well as the basic understanding of China's post-Cultural Revolution reality. For many observers and commentators, the formal disavowal of Maoism in the early 80s and the gradual introduction of economic reforms that undid much of the socialized economy of China presaged more dramatic change. People expected, people, experts, theorists, China specialists, government analysts, expected that these economic changes would inevitably lead to political transformation along with the social upheaval in China that was seeing the creation and then growth or reappearance of a massive middle class in that country. Agitation for this change took various guises in 1980s China, the most famous and clamorous being the nationwide protest, what I call the protest movement of 1989, sparked by the death of the then party general secretary Hu Yaobang. Those protests, which took as their focal point Tiananmen Square and the public spaces in dozens of other Chinese cities, gave voice to a range of inchoate frustrations. There were demands for greater freedom, calls for an open press, demands for an end to corruption and nepotism, opposition, in fact, also to China's involvement in the global economy, now an easily forgotten fact. In short, the protest challenged the party's monopoly on power and the party's monopoly on telling the Chinese what their story was. As we all know, those hopes were brought to an end by the murderous events of June the 4th. In retrospect, in particular, following the dismemberment of the Eastern Bloc and the collapse of the Soviet Union, China's 1989 mass protest seemed like a lost opportunity for the country to become a modern, progressive, westernized-like state, to fulfill the promise for prosperity, democracy, and pluralism that actually had been first envisaged in the early 1900s and that helped lead to the 1911 revolution that was celebrated throughout the Chinese world last year with the end of Chinese dynastic politics. Well, theoretically, anyway. For China's leaders, however, those under Deng Xiaoping and his fellows, and for the party propaganda apparatus, 89 was something else entirely. We understood it as a move towards openness and further democratization unleashed by economic reforms. For these party leaders and the propaganda machine since 89, the protests were neither spontaneous nor were they patriotic. They were part of a canny plot hatched by local malcontents and inimical global forces, in particular forces led by the Americans, The struggle of 89 was in fact a continuation of the anti-imperialist and anti-communist colonist struggle that China had been embroiled in since the First Opium War of 1840. To these thinkers, it was a struggle that had only intensified since the establishment of an independent People's Republic in 1949. Many forget now that the former Chinese Communist Party chairman, Mao Zedong, in 1959 had given a series of speeches about opposition to Western domination and exploitation. He spoke to party leaders at a closed conference in the West Lake in Hangzhou, South China, in response to John Foster Dulles, US State Department secretary, who had called for a form of peaceful evolution, a strategy that would encourage the nascent forces of democratic change, marketization, and constitutional possibility within Eastern Bloc countries and socialist countries to gradually undermine one-party rule. Mao identified this as the greatest danger to China's future. It's interesting to note, and very important to note, that in 1989, Deng Xiaoping recalled Mao Zedong's remarks and said, "The movement of 1989 was not a democracy movement. It was a continuation of this struggle against Western hegemonic desires to see China peacefully evolve into a modern bicameral democracy, which we mean to be a bourgeois democracy that is in the thrall of Western global capital and under the control of America. We will become, if we aren't careful, a vassaldom of the West." Now, this is a line that the Chinese authorities have pursued ever since, and to forget it is to misunderstand the story that not only the Chinese authorities continue to tell, but one they also tell themselves. A third disconnect came, they seem to come every 10 years, it's a strange synchronicity in Chinese events. A third famous disconnect comes in 1999. First, there was the mass protests at Falun Gong, the meditational sect practitioners, when they surrounded the party state compound at Zhongnanhai in central Beijing. They were repressed and declared to be an evil cult, and there's been a horrible repressive campaign that's followed on after that. Then later in the year, there was the accidental, supposedly accidental, bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, now again forgotten internationally, but in China not forgotten at all. The bombing was carried out by US-led NATO forces, and it led in China to a huge nationalistic outpouring of outrage and fury. The first disconnect is far more recent. Came in 2008, a year of to be celebrated as China's coming out party, a great symbolic representation of China's re-emergence on the world stage. But we'll remember that that year began March-April with an uprising in what I call Tibetan China and the bloody repression that followed thereafter, as well as the violent reactions to international commentary on that. Following 1989, the Chinese authorities had realized that while they pursued a policy that was determined to keep the West corralled and also determined not to see political reform and transformation of the one-party state in China, they felt their young people in China had been misled by too much liberalization and all these foreign ideas. So they launched a massive nationwide multi-billion dollar campaign in 1990 that has lasted now for 23 years. It's called a campaign in China's basic national realities. In Chinese, it's called Guo Qing Jiao Yu. And this is a campaign that has been instituted from primary school right through to university. And it's repeated constantly. It's part of a campaign not only aimed at appreciating the material benefits brought by modernization, international trade, China's involvement with the global economy, but also in emphasizing China's what is called unique spiritual culture. Now, I won't go into the details of this discourse about spiritual culture. It appears in Japan, China, and South Asia throughout from the late 19th century. What is important is the discussion of the need for China to build its own unique spiritual culture, its unique approach to the world, has been a discursive practice, a way of talking that has been around for over a century. It's not the invention of the Communist Party. It's not the invention of the one-party state in China. One recalls that one of the first people to talk about this need was that thinker I mentioned earlier, Liang Qichao, famous reformer, one of the great thinkers of the Chinese 20th century. He attempted to work with the emperor, the Guangxu emperor, in the late 19th century to carry out much-needed dynastic reforms in favor of modern education, in favor of trade and transformation of China's economy. He later became a famous agitator. He also visited Australia, very famously in 1900 and 1901. In fact, he was here during the Federation Year of Australia. It was the year of our federation, and Liang even attended a gala function in the Sydney Town Hall on the 12th of January 1901, 101 years ago. It was held to celebrate the creation of the Commonwealth of Australia. And the first Prime Minister of our nascent nation, Edmund Barton, was also present. This was a foundational moment for this country, 101 years ago. It was also one linked profoundly with the story of the Chinese in Australia and Australia's engagement with China. As one of my colleagues, Gloria Davies, has noted, the formation of the Australian Federation in 1901 introduced further restrictions on Chinese immigration, which had been going on since the mid-19th century with the gold boom. One of the first acts of the Australian Federation was the creation of the Immigration Restriction Act, which became famous, of course, as part of the White Australia policy, something that recently our opposition leader Tony Abbott commented on during his July trip to Beijing this year. Ironically, as a White Australia was being created, thinkers like Liang Qichao were trying to imagine an expansive and progressive future for China, and they were being inspired in part by what was happening in Australia. Despite the politics regarding the Chinese, Australia's ability to come together in a federation to generate this new nation with a whole range of possibilities and hope was something that helped inspire China's own eventual 1911 revolution, one of the many factors that inspired it. During his time in Australia, when Liang Qichao was here, national attention was also focused on China, in no small part due to the reporting of an Australian-born former British subject, Georgie Morrison, who was the correspondent for the Times. Morrison famously wrote from the front line on the Boxer Rebellion of 1900, and also wrote about the flight of the imperial rulers to Xi'an in West China. This was then followed by the bloody repression of the Boxers, protracted peace negotiations that involved an international invading force, including Australian troops under British command. It also led to dramatic transformation of China, new reforms, as they were called, Xinzhong, policies that were actually later frustrated, reappeared in the 1930s, and then reappeared again in 1978. Therefore, I'm saying there's a continuity not only in the China story, but also the transformations that have been happening in China are not unique to recent years, but a part of a very long story. At the time that Liang Qichao left Australia, he went to Japan and published a new magazine, very influential magazine, called The Journal for the New Citizen, Xinmin Bao. Among many things, he wrote an article called On New Historiography, in which he said China had to learn to tell itself a new history, to create a history that matched its modern status as a new nation state. Now, there's no time in a short lecture like this to go into all the other factors that led to those late Qing Dynasty and early Republican era elements that have fed into what we now think of the People's Republic of China, the party state of communist China today. But all of these factors have a profound impact on what China has become. And to blame them on or to understand them merely as the creation of recent decades, the creation of the Communist Party, is to misunderstand the last 100 or 150 years of Chinese history and the way that the Chinese narrative and its trajectory has been working and unfolding. And this is relevant for Australia and our experience with China. Of course, telling tales to ourselves, creating national narratives, is nothing unique to China by any means. America is famous for it, the French, the Italians, the British. We in Australia, of course. We have seen our own country tell itself various stories from various angles and various ideological points of view. Stories and accounts of bloodshed and loss, warfare and adversity, the forging of national identity in the blood of martyrs are common items in the cultural repertoire of many modern states. I think, for example, of the anniversary of the disastrous Gallipoli landing on the 25th of April this year, 2012. Speaking at the dawn service in Turkey, our own Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, remarked that Anzac Day has organically grown into something of significance for all Australians. Corporal Robert Smith, awarded the Victorian Cross in Afghanistan, and a soldier who had four relatives at Gallipoli in 1915, said to a journalist that Gallipoli is about the founding of our Australian values and our Aussie spirit. Gillard went one step further when she told us that Gallipoli was even more significant than the creation of an independent nation at the time of federation in 1901. Dare say, the famous polemicist Liang Qichao, a man appalled by the havoc of World War I, an event that had profound impact on China's creation of a communist party and its rise as a modern nation, because the materialistic West had destroyed itself in the eyes of Chinese thinkers in the 1910s. For him, the Gallipoli campaign, the First World War, was not a moment of forging nationhood. Rather, it was the federation, that bringing together of disparate colonies to create an extraordinary new country, that was a major achievement, and for which he's found hope for Chinese federation and a new country, a new modern nation-state free of desperate and despotic dynastic behaviour. Now, of course, China and Australia are by no means alone in this recent obsession for codifying what it is to be ourselves. Many other polities faced with real and perceived threats in this age of heightened nation-statism are all doing the same. What is particular is not the actual content of the values that various states propound, but the political will to undermine the civil and the civic, to cavil and create what political power holders regard as being acceptable norms and standards for society as a whole, mostly in consultation with themselves and their specialists, their thinkers. This is a process that has unfolded the other end of economic reforms in China that have seen the rapid privatization, or one could argue, reprivatization of social life and community. As I remarked earlier, time was rebooted for China in 1979 with the end of the Cultural Revolution and the launching of the Communist Party's what they call new era of open door and reform policies. It's called in Chinese a second liberation, the Erzi Jiefang, the first liberation being in 1949. In China, the story of the reforms is one about how history is being realized, how the struggle for a strong, wealthy, and modern country dating back to the 19th century was now possible, but only possible under the unified, harmonious, and directed leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. Of course, in the last 70 years, there have been mistakes. There are mistakes. Lessons have been learnt, however, and China was back on track and stronger than ever before. In the 1990s, outside China, including Hong Kong and Taiwan, which one should never forget in discussing the People's Republic of China, because they too are China, a very particular form of China, popular characterizations of the mainland readily invoke a grand narrative that tells another story from that of the Communist Party. One about how following the disasters of Maoism, the last bastion of recalcitrant one-party rule, that is China, the People's Republic, would inevitably be undermined by economic reforms and the liberating pressures of technology, social change, and global markets. This is a view that presented us with an inexorable logic. Market diversity will result in increased commercialization and embourgeoisement. The growth of new social forces as well as general liberalization will in turn engender political, social, and cultural pluralism in China. In China, reason and self-reflective analysis among popular writers and academics is all too often stymied, not only by the fiat of publishers, but also by mass sentiment. Perhaps that is why the West, that is Europe and America, or Euro-America, often doesn't appear to have much of a chance in China, just as China is figured as this monolithic totalitarian state that will inevitably see revolution and modernization along lines that we find acceptable. In China, the West is also characterized in a particular way. From that script, the United States is now the sole surviving global hegemon. In a unipolar world, it is the policeman of the planet, and we're always described in Australia as the cat's paws, or the henchman of the states. America's in cahoots with NATO and the European Economic Union. The monolithic power of US Inc., even in its present enfeebled state, will go to any lengths to impose its will on others, especially those who would dare and challenge its international droit de seigneur. In the name of national security, it suckers a commercial empire, and even in decline, it furthers the imperial domination pursued by its multinational companies and regional minions. And that's the story generally put in. If you want to read about the Global Times, a daily newspaper in English in China, will give you that script, basically. This conflict of characters, caricatures in China and America and internationally, continues, and it influences and informs the China story at every turn. The storyline is often one of such simplicity. Now, in the year leading up to August 2008, that is the Olympics, the Beijing Olympics, the 29th Olympiad, there were widespread hopes that China would, with the global spotlight focused on it, show its best face to the world. It would be a coming out party. Surely it was inevitable that we would witness a period of greater openness in freedom and so on and so forth. If history, the past wasn't bunk, at least it would be shoved aside by the happier workings of the modern marketplace. Now, as I said earlier, the murderous events in Tibet and China in March, April 2008 dashed these hopes. Protests and then violence, first in Lhasa, then throughout parts of the People's Republic with large Tibetan populations threaten to become the main focus of China's Olympic year. For the international community, human rights in China are once again a major concern. And for the fourth time in 30 years, as I said, another disconnect, an us versus them clash in reporting and understanding of contemporary China erupted. An interesting chapter was added to the story of Australia's own particular involvement with China shortly after the suppression of the Tibetan riots. You may recall, in April 2008, on his first formal visit to the People's Republic of China, our then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd caused something of a stir when, in addressing a Peking University audience, voiced concerns about China's human rights record and the situation in Tibet. Although his speech was predominantly concerned with the numerous positive dimensions of the bilateral relationship between Australia and China, he was the first foreign leader to address an audience in Chinese, in the Chinese capital, before speaking to Chinese leaders in private, and to pointedly, if politely, dare to disagree with official China over a matter of internal politics and international concern. It's easily forgotten today that one of the reasons Rudd did this was that there was great pressure on him and the other major Western leaders, the leaders of the major Western powers, not to attend the Olympics because of the Tibetan riots. And he had felt one of the reasons he had to try and speak out was to try and create an atmosphere in which the other leaders felt that they could go to China. Easily forgotten today. Ever the diplomat, of course, Rudd decided to couch his terms using a hoary old Chinese expression. It's a word expression called zhengyou, a term that was so unfamiliar to the Central Committee propagandists that when it appeared on TV, when Rudd's speech was repeated in excerpt on television that night, they miswrote, in the subtitle, they miswrote the word. It's a term that means to be a friend or advisor, counselor, intimate, who dares to be truthful. And it is one that has a very ancient history in China, and one that quite surprised the authorities in China, since they're used to, their foreigners have to be well-behaved, cultivated, and pliant friends. Pengyou is the Chinese term. Once you're a friend, if you don't agree, you're an enemy. It's as simple as that. Rudd did something unpleasant in public, in front of students. Don't speak like that in front of the young, and in Chinese. Despite the hopes and fears surrounding the 29th Olympiad, the Beijing Games went on and were, as we know, a great success in many ways. It was just after the opening ceremony on the 8th of August 2008 that Kevin Rudd invited me, I've known him since he was a student in Canberra, to join him and a few other Chinese friends and officials to have an evening chat on August the 9th. They included a leading propagandist, a very high-level bureaucrat, who, in talking with us, emphasized that 2008 had demonstrated how important it was for China to tell more efficaciously what he called 中国的故事, the Chinese story, or rather, the China story. As is so often the case with such encounters, the party bureaucrat was interested in using the foreign to serve China. Indeed, he enjoined us in the tired language of friendship diplomacy, which has been so wonderfully studied by one of our former ANU scholars, Anne-Marie Brady, who's now in New Zealand, we should act as a bridge between China and the Western world, and we can help facilitate things by being pengyou, friends. Having spent my professional career as a historian attempting to understand, translate, and relate Chinese stories, and not just a monolithic China story, I remarked that it was the plurality of Chinese stories, be they in the People's Republic or globally, that form the natural bridge to truly understanding a complex, changing, and vibrant Chinese world. But the creation of a national narrative for China is not recent. As I've said, it goes back a long way, back to the 19th century. The China story, 中国的故事, has in recent years become part of the official narrative of the Chinese party state, part of China's propaganda state, is what it's called, and the Chinese authorities have put billions of dollars into advertising it, into creating new outlets. Times Square has a billboard that often has Chinese advertisements. There's such and such, he often creates campaigns for Chinese authorities. The Global Times and various other outlets are part of this process. But it's important, of course, nonetheless, despite my measure of cynicism, to understand, and for all of us to understand, what is the officially engineered Chinese China story, the China worldview. Just as we need to be mindful of how the guided Chinese media, that is the print to electronic media, guided and influenced by propaganda and this huge propaganda effort since 1991, and how the educational practice in China and how publishing works in China have created a type of Chinese flat earth. As people engaged intellectually with China, we particularly need to understand both the official discourse and its historical and ideological underpinnings, but to get a grip on larger Chinese realities and possibilities, uncertainties, we need to gain insights into how the past and present will also sculpt the future, how that China story coexists with all the clashing, contentious, unpleasant, uncomfortable Chinese realities that the authorities so assiduously helped to mould and guide and distort. In approaching the China story today, our role as both scholars and educators, people like me and my colleagues at ANU and at other institutions in Australia and elsewhere, our task is complex. It behoves us to bring an empathetic understanding to the task. We need to be alert to a scholastic pursuit for facts and contextualization, as well as being sensitive to understanding how the often raw emotions generated by history and propaganda create responses to current affairs that are often virulent and deeply disturbing. We also are aware of the nature of our own stories, individual, scholastic, social, and national. Of course, for our engagement with the China story is underpinned by how we also narrate and understand our own histories. But as academics, we have a different perspective or range of perspectives from the more narrow pragmatists or focus-driven politicians, or even the effective business people and judicious diplomats who deal with the People's Republic. As I've remarked before and elsewhere, my own vision of our work is one that is driven by a humanistic thought, by, to quote Clive James, is one, a thought that has a hunger, it has a scope, a vitality, and it shares an inner light. An inner light produced by all the aspects of life that illuminate one another in a honeycomb of understanding. Monolithic narratives don't work well with that type of a honeycomb. It is the environment of the university where contending ideas are expressed, and it's the environment where we act as a zhengyou ourselves. Following the establishment of the centre that I work in, it was funded by a relationship between the Commonwealth Government and the ANU, with the support of Kevin Rudd, then Prime Minister, in 2010. Our centre created a project called The China Story. You can visit this project site. It's a web presence as well as a real thing. Just www.thechinastory.org. It's an initiative that attempts to do a number of things. One is it produces the yearbook that Jared just showed you. The yearbook is on the website. It covers the last few years of China, facts about contemporary China from the Chinese media, as well as analysis by scholars of the South China Sea issues in Chinese international relations, analysis of demographic problems in China's economy, analysis of the contending models for economic transformation in China's leading cities and what Bo Xilai and the whole coup revolving around Bo Xilai is really about, we believe. It offers an insight into how the Chinese internet is manipulated and managed by authorities, how they actually do it, what mechanisms are involved. It offers an insight into popular Chinese belief systems and cults, and offers a whole range of comments on Chinese politics and culture. It also, through information windows throughout the book, it offers just raw information on what are the hot stories in China for the last few years, who are the major public figures, what are the major issues of public and official contention, how do the authorities try and control and manipulate reality. It tries to offer an overview of these last few years. It's a yearbook. We're already working on next year's book. It will be produced in July or August next year. And because we are a publicly funded institution, as I said, we decided not to go with a commercial publisher because, well, they needed a subsidy to get the book off the ground, but they also would have taken 10 months from the time of delivery of manuscript to publication. We finalized this text of our book on July the 1st. The book was launched by Ken Henry in Canberra on the 10th of August, 5 weeks later. The website also contains a number of other things that I'll just share with you very quickly. There's the whole book in downloadable PDF form, so you can download the whole book and print it yourselves. We will have a print-on-demand function, so you just have to pay $10, $12 for a print-on-demand version. We'll have that up in another week or so. There's a Kindle version. It doesn't work quite well enough for the illustrations as yet. And each of the chapters can be read separately in downloadable form or online, exactly as they are produced in the book. But the website also contains a lexicon. It's the beginning of what we hope will be a very major part of our work, and that is a lexicon of the key terms in understanding contemporary China. And these are the terms that we inevitably encounter when discussing China today. At the moment, we only have 6 terms up. We plan to, in the short run, have 20 or 30. And the key terms we've put up are Xinjiang, the renminbi, human rights, labor rights, and there's one on Chinese official propaganda and language, and on the Chinese internet. Each keyword introduces the official Chinese account of this word or kind of Xinjiang. It offers you the official Chinese version of what Xinjiang is, how long it's been part of the China, and so on and so forth. Then offers internal Chinese dissenting views of the same issue, mostly scholastic views of what are the real problems in Xinjiang, West China. Then it offers the international Chinese or Uyghur dissenting view of the same issue. Then it offers what is the international mainstream Anglophone English language media representation of these issues in the last 5 years. And in conclusion, it offers what is the academic best practice in this field in the last 5 to 10 years, and how did the academic field come about. It offers a timeline, personalities, and a glossary of terms. Renminbi offers the same. Official Chinese view, internal debates about the renminbi and its valuation, issues to do with the American debates about the renminbi, EU debates, and so on and so forth. So each lexicon item tries to introduce the range of China stories, offering those who are interested a snapshot in 5,000-6,000 words per item, an overview of what are all the issues. We're academics, we try and give you all the information we have. Each of us has our own particular view, but we believe it's important to understand what the propaganda state in China says, and there are sometimes very good reasons for doing so, and one should appreciate those, and also what the contending views in China, and the Chinese, if anyone's familiar with the Chinese world, will know contention, argument, and disagreement are at the very soul and heart of the Chinese world. And for the Chinese state to present this harmonized, collective, monolithic view is, to those of us who deal with China, always a visible thing. The website also contains the Australia-China story, which is an account, an ongoing, unfolding account of all the debates about China in our contemporary Australian media. It's still in a nascent form. There's only a few hundred items, but gradually every day we add more items to. If you want to know about the debates about Hugh White's latest book, we basically have all the major reviews and articles and speeches on that book, as you know, very contentious indeed, and so on and so forth. In conclusion, let me just very quickly say, after Kevin Rudd had the temerity to speak of a relationship with China built not on simple friendship, just agreeing with what China has to say about itself, what the party state says, but rather on the basis of a daring to disagree, I'd observed that Zheng You has still a powerful force in the Chinese world. And when writing about the need for a new practice of history 110 years ago, the Chinese thinker who I first mentioned at the beginning of this talk, Liang Xichao, referred to mirrors. Zheng You was regarded as being a thing. Telling the truth was a way of providing reflection, a different mirror on reality from the usual one that you wanted to see. Liang Xichao spoke of the mirror himself. He said, "What is history? History is that which records both the subjects and objects of the continuous activities of human society. It assesses their general achievement, seeks the relationship of causality therein, and serves as an auxiliary mirror for the general public to modern times. That which specializes in narrating the activities of ancient Chinese to provide the modern Chinese nation with an auxiliary mirror on our reality, that is called Chinese history." Now, our project, the China Story Project that I've spoken of today, and our book and our future work, aims to provide a series of such mirrors, not just one, but many mirrors, that reflect not only what the party state in China hopes to see when it gazes into the mirror of its own carefully constructed history, but also through various refractions to provide those who see Chinese history as part of the broader global enterprise of humanity with the dimensions that allow for a nuanced, informed, and complex understanding of China's telling stories. Thank you.
Jeremy Barmy, thanks for that. We've got till 7 o'clock for questions and discussion. The longer version of your paper, Anne, will run on our website when it's published. So we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here and there's a lot of interest, so we've got to be very brief with our comments. I'll just start off with a quick question. Would it be worthwhile going on a fact-finding visit to China? Are there any facts in China? Or is it all sort of opinion? I mean, do we really know what's going on in China?
We do. What's wonderful about China today is in our book we go into some of this, the detail, and you'll see if you read the daily press, you'll see much about what is called the microblog, the Weibo revolution of recent years. This is a mini blogging type of service that allows people, and hundreds of millions of people participate in this, to discuss and debate reality. For example, recently we've seen the trial of Bo Xilai, the fallen Chongqing Party secretary's wife. Bo Xilai's wife, who's called Bo Gu Horace Kai Lai, for those who are interested in such arcana. Her trial. She appears not quite like she used to appear, and there's endless debate on the Chinese internet about who really did appear. What was even better were there are people at the trial, in the audience, who got in there and blogged immediately after leaving all the details of what was actually said at the trial. So we have the official Chinese New China News Agency version and the People's Daily Little Announcement, and then we have this person who was sitting there in the audience writing out all the details of what everybody said, and they publish it, and all those details mutually contradict and completely go against the grain of the official account. That's one very small example. There is enough information and enough out there to know what are the major debates and discussions in China today. There are thinking, vital individuals who contest with each other in a lively fashion. This has not been seen, I mean, it's not free by any means, but people get away with more public and also semi-private, because the Weibo revolution is a semi-privatized form of revolution. Revolution in the sense that it's overturned the media domination of the party state, that we can have access to the Chinese world in unprecedented fashion. You do need to know Chinese, though.
I'd just like to add to that, Jeremy, and I don't think it's written about enough, but even in the South, which is the only place that I know intimately at the moment, the press is relatively very...
Oh, indeed.
I mean,
indeed,
you know, the Nantong Zhabao, which is now finally the... That Hong Kong Press refers to it as the liberal. Yeah,
it's
top.
Great newspaper.
Shenzhen television.
No,
there's a
no indeed.
Television,
I think that's
which is just very, very open. Mind you, every now and then it goes to an ad, and at the end of it they say, Xianchai would remind you is live.
No, indeed. And there are newspapers. It is interesting when people, just in recent years there's been talk about political reform in China, and the Chinese Premier, Wen Jiabao, has repeatedly talked about political reform. They could do it overnight. There is a law that was put together in 1983 on media reform in China that could be enacted tomorrow that would see these southern newspapers become the norm in China. And we would have, in China, you have extraordinarily interesting investigative journalists and writers who luckily have some outlets, but they would be nationwide if they were only allowed.
One very brief question.
Just speak up.
I'd be interested in your views on a couple of points. First of all, is the factionalisation of the party, which strikes me as being very, very deep and as institutionalised as the Labour Party's factionalisation. My second one...
greedy.
I think you're being a little bit too hard on them, because, in fact, if you look at the amount of power which has been given up by the party over the ordinary person's life, which in your youth and mine was completely... nobody had any thoughts of their own.
So the first question about the factionalisation of the party.
Let me say. So what has happened this year is we've seen, so the party is moving towards this period of transition from now until March, April next year, when party leaders and state leaders, state council and the party central committee, will see a transferal of power to the next generation of leaders. Before this had happened, we saw the fall of the Chongqing Party Secretary Bo Xilai, who is regarded as being one of the upcoming stars of Chinese politics, a very relatively charismatic figure with policies that were more populist. What has been made very evident by his fall and then the discussion in the Chinese blogosphere as well as the formal media is that the same old issue that's actually bedeviled China since, and been spoken about in China since the Song Dynasty, the 11th century AD, that is, what do you do with oppositionalist forms, people who are basically want to form a loyal opposition? The Chinese Communist Party, they actually has always had factions. In the past, they would purge them through line struggles. Lin Biao, Liu Shaoqi, and various other leaders would be purged. They would flee or whatever. In China today, these same factions still exist, but they aren't formalized, and there is great pressure within the party in debate about whether they should be formalized. Should we actually name a new left faction? And there's a group of neo-Maoists who want to be named, just that, and they're called the Children of Yan'an being the Communist Party wartime base, and then the right faction, the center faction, and that they believe that might be China's way of moving forward to a slightly more pluralistic yet still collective leadership. And these things are now discussed more openly than they have been for many, many years.
Okay. Yes, Avira, just stay here.
It's evident that the Chinese authorities are control freaks. And while we have this delightful game that you describe in this underground media, whatever, at what point does the pressure build to the point where we have serious worry that there is dissension has reached a level where it will fracture for control. I mean,
Tiananmen
Square was one example, the mistakes. I mean, at what point do the authorities begin to worry?
The authorities always worry. I mean, they're constantly concerned. And that's why they're constantly intervening with the media, constantly guiding it and moving it, and trying, not foolishly, but very intelligently, to trying to respond to many of the concerns raised. What's been very important in the last 5 years is the Chinese authorities launched a policy called the Harmonious Society Policy, which is aimed at improving the lot of the lower rungs of society who haven't as benefited from economic reform as much as others. And they instituted a range of policies to help these people out. But still the protests increased, in particular people whose land had been stolen from them, who had lost their jobs, who had various iniquities occurring throughout the country, and there'd be local riots and uprisings. So the authorities have changed their tack and named these people as the major cause for disharmony in the society, which has also been a failure. And so the government's changing tack at the moment. So these protests, the blogosphere, and the general white noise or red noise in the society actually does influence government policy. They're not non-reactive. They're constantly trying to react and respond in ways because they do believe, the Chinese authorities, despite their own awareness that the society is incredibly corrupt in many, many ways, it is a one-party state with many factions and many different interests, they do believe, a vast majority of people believe, that they are the only responsible political force in the country that can keep the country together and also guide China's modernization. And they also believe that the international community wants it just like that. Something that one should remember.
High official statistics indicate a massive increase in social disturbances over the last 15 years. How stable is China? And the second thing, how do they see Australia? What's our role, so to say, in 50 years in the great scheme of things?
How stable is China is the great question. Nobody knows. All we know is that the authorities in Peking, the Standing Committee of the Politburo, 9 men, they get reports every morning and afternoon on what's happening in reality throughout China, reported directly to them. Whatever's going on, they know it's bad enough for themselves to be more repressive now in the last 2 or 3 years than they have been for many years. Now that's an indication that there's enough reason for them to think it's unstable for them to act the way they act, and to arrest people like Ai Weiwei and jail Liu Xiaobo and these other figures. So they obviously have profound concerns. What's Australia to China? Very complex. It depends who you speak to. I think there were surveys carried out during the Shanghai Expo period, and I've forgotten all the details, but normal people I know, of course, are very kindly disposed towards Australia. They find there are naturally those problems to do with Australia's restrictive policies regarding foreign investment in Australia. That's becoming quite an issue in the Chinese media, and the media is one of the only ways we can gauge what people are saying and thinking. Restrictive immigration practices are always an issue, but there's a huge number of Chinese students studying in Australia, so they know more about us than perhaps we do ourselves. What is the future for Australia? I mean, I think David Uren wrote a very powerful book. The Australian economics editor wrote a book, From Kingdom to Quarry, or Quarry to Kingdom, which I'd say is the book one should read about contemporary China from the Australian perspective. It's a wonderful survey of all the big issues to do with the relationship. And still Australia is seen as a quarry. And dare say, as people say, as a food bowl for the future as well. But it's also seen as a place where a stable society, harmonious, people are very nice, not great social problems. So it's seen very differently from many countries in Europe and America. And also because it's weathered so well the global financial crisis, it's seen in a fairly positive light. But you know, again, it's too easy to make generalizations.
Tianjin?
Professor Bami, you know Chinese history very well, and you used to live in China for quite a while, and you made lots of Chinese friends, and you even know the Chinese, subtlety of Chinese politics. Now Chinese Communist Party is in power for more than 60 years. According to your personal perspective or observation, is there any possible future political change in China? Because we just had that conference 2 months ago in Australia. I was one of the men to host this conference. So I would like to listen to your observation, listen to your opinion. Thank you.
Well, China has changed already, and that is because part of the Chinese world, and that's, I won't go into the one China, two China, but Taiwan is an example. The Chinese authorities used to make the case that we can't democratize. The country's too big, people are too illiterate, our history, our traditions, our background, the way the burden of the past is too great, we can't possibly be what you in the West want us to be. It's not what we in the West have wanted. It's what the Chinese, large numbers of Chinese thinking people and caring people, not just intellectuals, but people for over 100 years have wanted. That is basic freedoms, basic human rights, basic rule of law. Whether you call it democracy or whatever, this has been a trinity throughout the 100 years of China. Taiwan has seen those things realized. Of course, the mainland says that the Taiwanese have got that because of they've made a lot of money out of the Vietnam War and the post-Vietnam War period, and it's held up and supported by the Americans. But Taiwan has become a modern Chinese world, or Sino-Taiwanese world, that is democratic, open, free, and stable. And it is the greatest problem for the People's Republic of China. There's no doubt about it, because it is a living proof that there can be another China.
There's a question right down the back there, yeah. And then up here.
Are the incidents and causes of dissent similar or different in the urban and rural
areas? Were the incidents and causes of dissent are similar or different in the urban and rural areas?
Naturally, the whole range, you name it. Whole range of things. Forced abortions in the countryside is a big issue. Most recently, a very famous issue has occurred. Illegal seizures of land are huge issues in the countryside. Legal processes, you know, there's just such a gamut of and difference. One of the complicating factors is that a lot of the urban disturbances are related to people who are, in fact, from the countryside, who migrate back and forth from the countryside and take many of the concerns of the urban world back to the countryside when they return. And this is both a negative and a very positive thing, because it means that many of the more, well, things that occur in cities, an awareness of your rights and what you're doing in labor disputes and so on and so forth, these ideas are taken back into the countryside and become the bedrock of protest and disagreement within the countryside itself. So there's a constant interchange between the two. It's not that easy. There are particularly rural concerns, but they are profoundly influenced also by what's happening in the city.
Now there's a question here. Yes, there we go. Yeah.
Thank you for your address. I found it wonderful. Really enjoyed it. I want to hear every word. We're constantly reminded of the human rights issues in China with Tiananmen Square and Tibet and so on. But there are a couple of things that have happened in Chinese history that just show a balance to that. One was the white Russians, and I know it goes back in history.
It's got to be brief.
The white Russians coming through into Harbin, the Russian, and also the Shanghai was the only place in the whole world that accepted the Jews fleeing from persecution in Europe. And those two groups of people had no papers, no passports, and China, I think, showed a wonderful social conscience in their acceptance of those two.
Question about the white Russians who made it to China and the Jews who made it to Shanghai.
One would remark that this is before the Chinese Communist Party took over China.
Yes.
But
yes.
No, indeed, it's not to say that the Chinese world is not one in which there's incredible inclusive, embracing attitudes towards things. Something the Communist Party is not China. The Communist Party is not the Chinese people. One has to be very careful to delineate the two. And human rights in China, just very quickly, I suggest you look at our website and the lexicon. We have a human rights article. I think it offers very well. The Chinese authorities say that we have done this and that and the other to improve Chinese living standards and so on. This is the greatest human rights policy that could ever be instituted. And they have a great point. It's one repeated by Paul Keating quite recently, I believe, when discussing Hugh White's new book. But there are other perspectives, what are the range of human rights. But those historical examples you raised are completely true. The party didn't react to foreign nationals in quite the same way after 1949.
There's a question right up the back. Yeah. Don't stand up. Yes. 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 Yes.
Okay. Yes. Recently, the Beijing tried to pressurize Hong Kong in changing the history curriculum in the schools. My question is that, is information out of Taiwan in terms of media and everything about, because Taiwan has a lot of spies in China as well, is the information accurate about China in Taiwan and what they publish in newspapers and so forth?
Is the information about China published in Taiwan accurate?
I'm a great fan of the Hong Kong Chinese press and have been for many, many decades. There are a whole range of press outlets in Taiwan. I don't read Central Daily anymore, but it depends what you read. You can read great detail in the mainland Chinese press. You can read great stories and discoveries in the Hong Kong press, on Chinese blogs written by people from all over the Chinese world, as you can get a good information from the Taiwanese media. I don't personally restrict myself to, or any of my Chinese friends do not restrict themselves to any one version of the Chinese story, whether it's from Taiwan or Hong Kong or the mainland. And I would say that I mentioned that Guo Qingjiaoyu National Education Campaign launched in 1991. Indeed, the Chinese authorities in Hong Kong are now trying to impose a new type of textbook in Hong Kong schools, and it's led to a great deal of upset since July this year, in fact.
Right down the back, yes. Yes.
Yes, I remember reading about Deng Xiaoping, wrote many years ago, of course, that the Communist Party could stay in power in China provided it kept increasing the standard of living of the people. Now, isn't that still a central idea? Politicians can have different views, but what works, to go back to what Deng Xiaoping said, and that in the end will guide the policy.
That is the official line in China. That political force that can provide stability for the nation, national unity, the protection of its territorial integrity and economic wheel of benefit will be the power that is the power of the Communist Party. And the Communist Party, this is the official line, is the only force that has proven over the last 60, 70 years to be able to provide all of those things. And it will continue to do so. This is why territorial issues in the South China Sea and with Diaoyutai or Senkaku and other areas to do with Tibet and Xinjiang are so powerful. Because it's not just about improving the standard of living, but it is also providing strong national integrity and independence. And the party argues full well that this is what it's achieved and will continue to do so.
And you say?
Well, it depends. I think that, as we all know, we live in a country where we say these things are contended and we don't take one party's word for it. And in China, nobody I know takes the party's word for it. But we have to be more aware of those contending voices.
There's a question here.
I was going to ask about the South China Sea. Can you expand on where you think that might be?
Oh, heavens. There's a great chapter in our book by Brendan Taylor, who just has a piece in The Australian today, on the South China Sea. It's a complete nightmare. As I believe a New York Times journalist wrote a piece last week quoting a leading Chinese strategic thinker saying, we don't claim all the South China Sea, we only claim 80% of it. It is completely nightmarish. And I think Hugh White is one of those people who argues that, I mean, of course, he argues in a certain direction, but he says it could be any minor incident or infraction that could lead to a flare-up in the area with the Philippines, with Vietnam, or with Malaysia, or with other regional powers, Japan, indeed. And it's not to say that the Chinese are unreasonable. There are, you know, everybody's a bit unreasonable involving the South China Sea. I don't have a partisan view, but it is a true mess.
Before we go to the last question here, would it be fair to depict Hugh Wright's position as we should find out what Beijing wants and give it to them?
I really don't. I know that when I've heard Malcolm Turnbull gave a launch speech in Canberra for the book after his monthly article, in which they discussed, used one of my high school favourites, the Thucydidean description of the Malayan debate about, you know, the strong powers decide what they must and we weaker forces must do as we must. I don't think... I think Hugh is an old friend, and I don't entirely agree with his thesis, but nonetheless he's somebody who's forced these issues into the public realm and into a form of debate that I find very enlivening and interesting. Hugh's ideas are one, as you know, deeply contended. I tend to be one of those people who question the thesis.
Final question, Simon.
We see the change of leadership coming up next year. It's been very smooth. We know, I think we know, who the next president is going to be, the next premier is going to be. But on the other hand, beneath the surface, there seems to be all sorts of excitement. I mean, the Mo Xianlai affair. Is it already decided and therefore over, or is something underfoot?
Final
question to those down the back about the Chinese leadership change schedule for next year.
I mean, what has been rather wonderful about this year and the Bo Xianlai incident, the purge and fall of the Well, the temporary fall, perhaps, of the mayor of Chongqing. I wouldn't. The party secretary of Chongqing. I don't know. Until it's over, it's not over. Rehabilitation is one of the great weapons in the armory of the Chinese Communist Party. The international community behaved as though China was going through a peaceful, orderly transition, the second orderly transition in the last 60 years of party rule. The Bo Xilai incident showed that that's not the case. And it's revealed the riven factionalism that's hidden, usually hidden very carefully, from public view. It seems to be rather orderly at the moment because the party is doing its very best for the international markets, and I think the international markets are very happy that it's going to be relatively peaceful transition, but it is hiding not only the profound factionalism, but the factionalism behind the factionalism are actually a war of ideas about the direction of the country, about globalization, about China's responsibilities in its region, to Europe, to the rest of the world. These are not just about whether we, the commies, are going to stay in power and be a one-party dictatorship and tell everyone else what to do. They are, it's part of a profound debate, as we're having in Australia, as people are having in the United States and Europe, about the direction of societies related to welfare, related to public benefit, related to the direction of economic transformation and the direction of social transformation. So that's what the factions are. They're not just fighting about who gets a larger slice of the cake. They're fighting about ideas as well. And this is something often completely disguised by what the party does, and that is it lets out bits of information about factional infighting and doesn't want to let us know about what the substantive ideas of difference are. But there are.
There's much more exciting.
Oh, many thanks, Jeremy. Let's take a seat. We'll only be a second. A lot of people here. I'll be very brief. Jeremy's obviously one of our best, one of the world's best China scholars. And it's great to have you here tonight. And on the occasion of the launch of the China Story Yearbook 2012, but bear in mind all the information on the China Story Yearbook at www.thechinastory.org. Tonight we've had a stimulating address about contemporary China, lively, witty, thoughtful, just what you expect from Dr. Barmy. Thanks for coming, and no doubt we'll have you back on yet another occasion. But for tonight, well done, and congratulations on your new publication.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.